I'm Tommy Beardmore.
I'm Adam DiCarlo.
And welcome to Before the Break, a podcast for actors
by actors.
Brought to you by Book It.
Alrighty. Hey, Tommy.
Hi, Adam. It's so good to see you.
You too.
We've got a lovely, lovely guest today. I'm very, very excited because for those listening, we're starting a new series. It's a director series for us to talk to up-and-coming directors, successful directors, people who've been on sets over the years of their professional careers, to talk about the relationship with actors, the audition process, what to expect on set, the do's, the don'ts, the stuff that they like, the stuff that they don't. If we're more experienced, more knowledgeable about what to expect, especially talking with directors, then that will ensure our success on set. So this week's guest is a Cajun filmmaker and screenwriter who has catapulted himself into the entertainment industry. Last year, he made a studio feature film. Last year, he made his studio feature film debut with the drama Echo Boomers, starring two-time Academy Award nominee Michael Shannon. His other films have played in film festivals all over the world. Please welcome film director and screenwriter Seth Savoy.
What's up, guys?
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Glad to talk to you guys.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you guys, too. It's been forever, Tommy. It's been forever.
I know it is. It's been a long time. Seth directed Life and Death of an Unhappily Married Man back in 15 or 14. I don't know, Seth, was that your first indie feature film? I can't imagine.
I was the cinematographer on that one. So that was like my second or third one that I'd shot at the time. And then kind of after that, I went full throttle on Echo. So.
Did I just call you the director?
Yeah, you did.
I really?
Yeah, you did.
Josh is like, what the hell? Yeah.
Josh directed that.
Okay, yeah. you were a cinematographer. You were the DP. You were there every single day, at every moment, in every situation. And I got to tell you, of all the indies that I've done, there was something so special about. And we'll get into it, but the choices you made and then the composure that you had on set, I see. And Adam, I know you see this too. And we have a DP on set like Benjamin or, you know, anybody like that, you know, you can tell their work ethic, their character, there's something inside of them that makes them a really good DP. And part of it is that constant presence of just composure. And you know that you can count on that person to not freak out. And the DP is at the very, very head of this huge, huge umbrella. And you're really the driving force with that crew. So I appreciated like every single day and every single moment that you put into that movie. But, you know, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. There's so many questions. A lot of these actors, you know, we've been interviewing a lot of actors talking about the struggle and how to get through it and how to get the agent and all that stuff. What we haven't talked about is from the director's standpoint. Let's first start with where you began your career and how you set yourself apart to kind of gain some traction there.
Yeah, so I tried to go to Columbia and it took I went 2 years in Arkansas and I shot like music videos forever to get in. And eventually I got in. And what I ended up doing was I ended up writing a script, which was Echo Boomers. And it won a Sundance Independent Pitch Competition in 2015. And so from there, I kind of had this option of, you know, I had three or four different offers from either producers that were really connected to studios or from studios themselves. And saying, hey, we want to buy this from you.
I'm sure you hit some snags, Seth. I mean, in the writing process and all that resistance where you're hitting walls of creativity, you're saying, oh, Jesus, what another script that nobody's going to read or whatever. I mean, did you surpass those speed bumps?
Yeah, I mean, personally, with the writing process, I knew that my story was so good. I knew that people were going to read it. And like, your pitch is everything, right? Like if you pitch it well,
I love that. I know it's so fucking good.
but
you have to have that confidence.
That's the thing,
though.
Exactly, because when you talk to someone, they don't hear that confidence every day. And so even if it's not,
and
that
especially
good,
like you just said, if you're pitching, if you're excited about it, the whole point is to get them excited about it so that they want to produce it or buy it or whatever. But you have to have that so they go, well, Jesus, you sound so fucking interested. I got to get interested. So yeah,
exactly. Exactly. That's
well,
like
you know, it's kind of like acting too, Seth. If I come into a room and I'm hesitant and I'm like, I'm Tommy Beardmore, I'm 5'9", and I'm just happy to be here. It's like, well, obviously we're not going to give him the role. Like he doesn't even trust himself.
Right, yeah.
You know, and it's not false confidence. I mean, you know that you're good at what you do. You have a good story. There's no reason why someone wouldn't want this, and you take that energy into the room, just like any actor. I know I'm good. I know what I can do. They might not pick me. But I'm at least here and I deserve to be here, you know, and people can sense that.
Absolutely. And so normally with that script particularly, that's just kind of how I acted about it because I knew the story was good. And yeah. That got it read for sure. And that got people interested and that, you know, for me, it's funny that we're going to talk about casting because that was the part that was the biggest hurdle for me. So let me get there first. So I told these studios and I told these producers, know that I wasn't going to sell it because it's my baby. And if you're not going to let me direct it, then I'm going to do it myself. And so like,
I was sorry not to cut you off. I was going to ask you about that. Like if people are asking to, or if people are interested in buying your script, a lot of times that means that's where your story ends with your script. And then they take it because now they own that. And a lot of times, if you're up and coming or if you're a no name, they'll be like, thank you so much. We love it. We're going to take it now. It doesn't always
mean we're
going to
ruin it now.
Right? It doesn't always mean that the baton stays with you and you get to see it through as the director or the DP. So there, you know,
exactly
it's not so much like,
yeah,
oh, you want to buy it? I'm going to direct. That's not how that works.
Not at all.
And for people listening at home, just so you know.
Yeah,
good like, for you for sticking with it.
I was a first timer, you know what I mean? So they looked at me and they said, look, some people would give me writing credits. Other people said, Seth, we're going to get a bigger name guy on this, but we're going to pay you, you know, six figures. You'll love it. It'll be great. And so I just told them no, that if I wasn't attached to direct it, then it's a pass. And so they
if you weren't a director, Seth, you would have sold that script easily, but you know your muscle and you've got two muscles. And you know, there is a way to employ all of your talents. If you like, for me, I'll go on and produce my movies because I know the festival circuit. I know how to get distributors, and I'll come on as an extra credit because I know that's my muscle. So you had directing, and obviously this paid off. So what was the process going into your involvement? And
well, yeah, so that was it was kind of tough because for probably 2 years. No one would touch the project because they'd make some phone calls and they'd say, oh, well, he told the studio no. And now they don't want to work with him. So that's that. And so for like 2 years, it was tough, man. I was trying to cast people and I just kept on getting like the door shut in my face. And then I ended up just through kind of the grace of God. I met a producer here in Chicago named Sean Kaplan. And Sean, I met him at Soho House here in Chicago. I go and he said, hey, let me read your script. And he read it and he got it in front of the right people. And maybe 2 weeks later, they were saying, yeah, Michael Shannon will do your movie. He's a part of my
family. Can I ask? That's incredible. Can I ask when you met him, can you say his name again?
Yeah,
Sean?
His name's Sean Kaplan.
Yeah. You know, you said you met him where?
I met him at Soho House in Chicago.
And was that just a chance meet? I mean, I'm really interested in, I always love to hear how this big thing happened, but it's usually per chance. It's usually something that preceded it that was just like, yeah, it just filled in the blank.
So
we
I have a Talkhouse article that you guys should link to this episode. But Talkhouse is just like this indie kind of film magazine that talks about the chances that happen in our art form and like how those things are the things that actually make people. And they did a whole article on like the probability of me meeting Sean that day and the probability of all that stuff, which is kind of cool. It's definitely worth
interesting.
Yeah. But it's one of those things. If I would have decided not to go out that day or, you know what I mean? We probably
something. Yeah. There's some force
like
that was fueling you.
It's like how Reservoir Dogs got made. Like Quentin sent it to friends in New York and they sent it to people, and it eventually, by no work of Quentin, got to Harvey Keitel, and he loved it so much he wanted to be on as a producer. And then eventually, when the word got back to Quentin in LA, and he was like, what? How the fuck does Harvey Keitel even have my script? Like, how does that happen? Yeah, sure. And it was just because somebody loved it and went, you got to see this. And that person went, hey, you got to see this. And eventually, but that was not in the works with Tarantino, but sure, that's right, just how it happened. And then with Harvey's name on it, it got made. But shit like that happens all the time.
Sure. Yeah. And so that was kind of the connection. That was kind of one of those things. And so, yeah, Sean was a part of Michael Shannon's team, and he introduced me to Shannon's producer or his manager named Byron Wetzel, who was my manager for a long time. And it just kind of connected, you know.
And what was the timetable for that then, from meeting Sean, 2 weeks that people are talking? And then when are you going into the pre-production?
Maybe like 2.5 years later.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's one of those things, like, we had a piece of the puzzle for sure. So I think this movie, its entire span from like starting to write it to it being shot and done is about 7 years. Which is,
and to think that people think like Seth just, it just was given to him. My God, he's young. Happened.
You see these reviewers and they're like, I don't believe it. And you're just like, okay. It's like, cool.
Obviously you never made a movie.
But it's just part of the thing. It's part of it. But no, so like 2 years of writing, 2 years of really not being able to talk to people, kind of shut out, 2 years of like, it finally all coming together, maybe a year and a half of it all coming together. I mean, on this show alone, I mean, we originally, you know, Patrick Schwarzenegger is the lead. We originally had Nick Robinson at one point. We had Dacre Montgomery from Stranger Things. We had Theo James playing Alex Pettifer's part at one point. We were talking to John Malkovich for a little bit. I mean, like the amount of time that it takes to get someone of that caliber to read a script, make a decision, check out the deal points, see if it's legit. Then you have to raise the money at that point, right? So it's like you're still scrambling to kind of sweep it all together. But that part was exhausting, man. I mean, that part was just unbelievable.
And how did you go from the pitch email? I mean, they obviously had to look at the stuff that you've done. You were doing music videos. Now, I'm wondering if any of the past films, were they watching your past work to see what you could do? Or it was like, hey, if you've done these music videos, really good stylist.
Yeah, normally music videos I don't even talk about. I did one piece for New York City Ballet in 2015. Oh, okay. And that thing was unbelievably beautiful. So normally with the script was this kind of like 4 or 5 minute New York City Ballet piece that I did. But yeah, and then it just kind of became like, you really have to have a producer that's really close to these agents to actually get people to read it, which is just kind of a hurdle of its own, especially being a first timer, you know?
Yeah. 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 Wow. And during the initial process, were there feelings of imposter syndrome when you were in that room with all those people and you're like, I created this mountain and now it's time to scale it? Did you have doubts?
A little bit. I mean, more doubts of figuring out how to raise this money more than anything. The creative part, I knew I could figure that part out. But it was,
what was the budget?
It was $3 million. $3 million at the end of the day.
It's a lot of millions.
And every single one of those dollars you gotta pay back, you know? So it's not a charity case, that's for sure. We ended up doing great, man. I mean, one thing that I really, you know, the casting process in terms of finding bigger actors, I mean, it's exhausting, right? Because you don't have those relationships. But once you begin to work with them, it really kind of loosens things up. But, you know, we had some people in Echo that were no-name guys that, like, I think are going to be as talented as Michael Shannon. Like, we had our second lead. His name is Gillis Geary, and he's a Juilliard grad, and he just has an unbelievable presence on screen. And, yeah, I found him in an auditioning room.
Can I ask you, Seth, you know, there people have names and followers and all that stuff. For the people that don't, and it's just they're banking on their talent alone, you've seen people come into the room. You've been on set with a lot. I mean, even Life and Death, there were 30 actors. You've been in the audition room. What is the thing that, and I know what you just said, it's he has that magnetism or whatever that thing is. What do these actors have that sets them apart who don't have the big following in the name? What do you see consistently? It's like when they leave the room, you're like, wow, that was good. What are they doing?
That is such a, that's like a $1 million question, right? If like, if we knew that answer, then every actor would be doing it. But
well, and there are a couple bullet points. It's being present and not making this whole thing the most important thing in the world, this sort of abandonment of control and obsession, sort of like the, I could do this or I could also go to lunch and be perfectly fine. That desperation is a tough thing. The preparedness, the unique choices, but really, I think it comes down to this really deep thing that's in here that sort of seeps out of you naturally as someone that has sort of a magnetism or an intrigue or engaging, some sort of element that's just unique to that individual person. And yeah, can you even name it?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the biggest thing, which, you know, they teach this a lot in acting, but I think it's underappreciated. It may be talked about a little bit too much, but it really, like, when you meet someone that truly listens, like they're just a magnet. Do you feel like a magnet to that person? And just the way that they listen to you. I mean, obviously there's a difference between like active listening and acting, but a lot of those really good guys, I mean, you're seeing what's going on behind their eyes, even though they're listening. And that goes so far, you know, it goes just an unbelievable distance. And
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it's not even the acting in the, well, most of the time it's not the acting in the lines, it's the reacting from the lines. And, sure. You know, we've seen that time and time again where you're an editor's best friend if you know how to listen and react, because it's some of those shots that they kiss where you're taking that information in. That's telling the story.
Absolutely.
It's nonverbal. And that's what most communication is, nonverbal. So listening, man, and improv, thank God, because that's the best way to be in the moment and listen when you've got the pressure of 30 minutes in a show and you've got to pay attention to the person so that you can say the line again. So there are ways to get in that present mindset and to listen, but it takes a long time and it's a rare thing because actors just want to say their line, right?
Sure.
Actors just want to say their line. So it sounds like you found some amazing people, and let us in on like kind of the process is as far as the actors go on set. Mm. And you're on a higher tier now. You're dealing with actors that are absolute professionals. What was the difference between what you've had before and what you saw in this film?
You know, a lot of it just comes down to how many times someone's done something. I'm going to say that again. It just comes down to how many times someone's done something, right? Like, just like with anything in the world, if you do it enough, you're going to be better at it. And with a lot of these guys, that's what it really came down to. Like, sure, Shannon has like this skill level that almost seems unobtainable and so natural that you're like, how in the world did he get there? But I think even himself, he would say that just comes from practice. That just comes from doing it more than any other person. And it seems like this naturalistic thing, but you've just found your groove as an actor. And a lot of them were like that. And personally, I'm not someone who has to stick to this like really rough, you have to say every line type thing. I think that acting is a very, it's like a liquid, like it's this really loose thing and you just kind of have to let it shape how it's going to shape. I mean, that was the real difference. And the level of trust was higher than any other place. You know what I mean? Like
for you trusting him?
For both.
For anyone, both. Yeah, for both.
Which that's beautiful too. The fact that Shannon has done this, you know, 150 times, and I'm doing my first movie, and he trusts my direction because he has to, and that's just kind of, and he embraces that and accepts that and learns how to use it, and it's kind of a really cool thing. And then you know, obviously that just kind of builds this relationship of complete trust.
Yeah, cool. Man.
Yeah.
And now, Seth, on a communication level, what did you find different between shooting actors as the cinematographer and directing actors as the head of the ship, as the director?
It's like two totally different machines. Like those guys who do both, I have no idea how they do it, because, you know, one, you know, as the DP, you're thinking about lighting ratios and camera movement, and you're looking at so many things and you have so many kind of pieces to the puzzle. You can't really focus on the acting, right? Like, thank God that's someone else's job, because I just got too many things on my plate. But
Adam directed and starred in Lost and Found, what, two years ago. And you were just like, yeah, I'm not doing that again. I'm just going to focus on one thing.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, after a take, it's like, yeah, all right, I got 20 notes. You know what I mean? It's going to take me all day just to get these notes out of the way before we even do take
yeah,
two.
Yeah, I've written and directed two short films. And after the first one that I wrote for myself, I was like, the second piece is infinitely heavier. And I mean, it's a real drama. And I was like, yeah, I want to be able to watch the monitor the whole time. And really, because I loved directing so much, I want to live in that world. I don't want to have to worry about seeing it later, like in editing, because there's just not enough fucking time to film it all and then watch it all while you're still on set. And so it was so much more enjoyable to just like be able to relax and be like, I don't have to be on screen. The things that I'm going to worry about are infinitely different than if I was, you know, wearing the writer, director, and actor hat.
Totally.
Working actors deserve affordable and convenient coaching. That's why we created Book It, America's fastest growing one-on-one remote acting coach service, all from your device. We're not just coaches, we're working actors too. From Broadway and voiceover animation to TV, film, and commercial, real actor coaching from real actors, catered especially to you and your path. Anytime, anywhere, we're here to train you, to guide you, to prepare you, to book it. For more information, visit workingactorpro.com/bookit.
Seth, as far as now that we are talking about, a little bit about the dancing with the camera movements and with actors of that level, did you find that they had a synchronicity or some connection to the director, the DP, where the camera was, the turnarounds and the movements? And because it kind of can get algorithmic. If I'm, let's say, Life and Death, and we're on day 10. You kind of anticipate the DP and what they like and what they want. And so I'm standing in my mark way ahead of the camera movement because I know where we're headed. So that kind of awareness, I'm sure, is really, really important for actors. Do you see that with the kind of higher level?
Absolutely. On a different level, man, of like, and it's the small things too, that like some actors, like with Shane, and in particularly the things that he was doing was someone who had done this for 20 years in terms of like, and it's the little things that I don't think about or even notice in the moment, but it's when I'm editing it in the editing room. And so we had this long scene that was like 7 minutes, seven characters. They all needed coverage. We couldn't really chop it up. It's just like something we had to do. And, you know, Shannon was walking around and addressing each one personally. And when you look at the takes again, he itches his elbow the same moment of the 7 minute take every single time. And you start to realize it's just like, you didn't, it looks so natural. It looks so just like he was that character. And you were just engulfed in the performance. You didn't even realize this happened at that time.
Yeah. And that's when you're taking into account the editor. Mm. And when I take this, we're on one shot and I'm drinking this coffee. When we turn around, I know that I'm drinking that coffee at that same exact moment. And not only does it help the actor or the editor, but but if you know how to choreograph your movements and you're in control of what you do, you can stay in that moment. And actually, the more stuff that you kind of pepper in, those are place cards and chapters that you kind of touch base with as you go through this 7 minute long scene. And you know you've got this map now because this is the elbow thing. This is where I look this way. And then by the time you're done, it's like you've hit all these places and it's all familiar and home because you had this sort of choreography. You didn't just wing it. And you don't give the problem to the editor on how to get this coverage where he scratches here, but I have to cut this and he doesn't scratch. Like, that's what somebody who's been doing this for 20 years will do. And you got to remember that. It's not just about the acting and the authenticity. It's about the facilitation of the scene and making your job easier and his job easier and the editor's job easier.
Sure.
But it's all just stuff that you have to learn, and there's no other way to do it but just to do it. So,
and that's a real professional, someone who is hyper aware of when his job is done, that somebody else's job is to put it all together. And Michael is aware, I can't fuck the editor up, because if I fuck the editor up, we can start fucking up the scene, and then you guys have to get creative when
you guys have
a yeah.
Then you guys have a shitty movie that I'm starring in. You know what I mean? It's, it's just a
snowball. And it's one of those things where it's every little thing, even if it's the itch of an elbow. That's choreography, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing it so many times and so many different takes and coverages and angles and all that, it all has to be the same. But that's a fucking professional, because he knows when my job here is done, somebody has to put it all together, and I can't fuck up that person. Because the last thing you want is, shit, this is our favorite take, but he doesn't do the elbow. And if we turn around, he hit.
The quality decreases instantly when you make
Will anybody
mistakes,
notice?
You know?
Probably not, but we notice, and we don't want that. You know,
I
we
would.
Don't want,
yeah.
You know, we don't want a little thing like that that's going to drive us fucking crazy. So
yeah, totally. Totally.
That's awesome. So there are things that you're seeing that they're doing right. What in your tenure as a director have you seen actors do wrong? What are those consistent things that, say, amateur actors who are just starting out, maybe in their first 5 years, making these mistakes on set that you're like, green.
Yeah. How was Tommy on set?
That's fucking funny, dude. That's hysterical.
I think it's one of those things that, like, it's such a dangerous art form because you can get in your own head so quickly, right?
Yeah.
And once you're there, it's really hard to get out. And it's one of those things that, like, if a lot of actors just, like, if they're stuck, literally take 5 minutes. Don't keep trying, because you're just going to keep banging this nail that's trying to come out. And just, like, take 5 minutes, reset, realize that, like, I don't know. For me, it's funny how, like, on set can become so serious, right? Money's being spent. You know, you only got so much time, all this other bullshit. When in reality,
time is, like, money on set.
Yeah, but you have, like, one of the coolest jobs in the world. So, like, once you take that step back and kind of realize that at the end of the day, this doesn't fucking matter. It really doesn't. And I don't know, it just kind of loosens everything up. But I feel like some actors, you know, they take it a little too seriously. And some of them, that works. And some of them, it just kills them, you know?
Yes. Yes. Sometimes it's abandoning the obsession of this thing that we know is going to make us happy. That the first step is to just say, dude, this is not the thing. And the more that you stay in this business with people being very successful, with a lot of money or fame or whatever. I mean, let's face it. Some of my most financially successful friends are the most unhappy. So this stuff is not going to make you happy. You know, you got to find the happiness from the coffee at Crafty, not the actual booking of the job. It's the people.
Yeah. That's a good way to put
it. So yeah, there's a lot of problems with actors who kind of, you know, they're in their first 5-10 years, and I think it comes down to, we work so hard to get to a place where we can actually make money. And now it's like the pressure's on to do well. And we forget that, like, this is just a job, and this is just what you do. And then you're done today, and then you go off and do other things. It's not brain surgery, you know?
Sure.
Okay. So, let's talk about, problems like on set. Have you ever encountered problems from actors where everything could have been avoided? Do you see problems with ego and, preparedness. I mean, that's a huge thing. They say, and I know this is totally false, but they say, you know, you can tell the difference between an LA actor and an LA guest star and a New York guest star. If they're learning their lines in the makeup chair, they're from LA. So, like, there's the joke that, you know, actors, we want this so bad, yet we will look three times at an audition, you know. So as far as preparedness goes, do you see that a lot where actors are like, you should have spent a little more time on this?
So I have directed things where I've never seen people more prepared in my life. But I've also produced things where, like, you're wondering what the fuck is happening. But majority of the time, it comes down to the age of the actor. Right? If you're dealing with a 20-year-old who just got one huge show and now you're booking her for something else, then, you know, that could be something that's, you know.
Say her name, Seth. Say her name.
I mean, that's a huge thing. Or, like, yeah, I mean, my only troubles have been with younger actors who, you know, all of them under, you know, maybe 22 or 23. We're just young to the industry and just got a huge movie. And, you know, maybe it's not
think you're hot shit.
That they really want to do. You know what I mean? It's just, yeah, it's, that's really the only thing, because I feel like majority of other actors know how rare it is for what they get to do. And if you book something, how rare it is to book something. If you're on a network television show, how rare it is to be on network television. I mean, I don't know. It's funny though, because when you do go into those auditioning rooms, it's wild how, like, I'd never before Echo, I'd never like really sat down with like high level casting directors and, you know, train people in and see them again and again and again. And you have, you know, 30 people a day to see, and they're all kind of up and comers and they all have opinions about them. But it's pretty wild to see these, you know, you got to be careful as an actor, because you do one thing to rub that casting director wrong. I mean, they're talking to me about it. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, he wanted to read for this, but for some reason he thought he was reading for this. He might just want that role. It's like they're six steps ahead every single move that an actor makes. An actor's late. It's like, oh, well, you should have planned that better. Now you're one notch down in their mind. Like, it's just a really intense thing, man. And I just don't know how some actors do it, man. It's like you pour your heart out to the love of your life on a blind date. And then it's like, nope, you're not good enough. All right, next. It's like, Jesus, how many times gotta do this? You know what I mean? It's
yeah,
like,
in an instant, you can work real hard and have the key to a lot of rooms. And if you do something like you're late, I mean, just being 10 minutes late without a call, and they're like, listen, we've got too much to do, and we don't screw with this. Too many actors are late. Get out of here. You'll come back next year.
Yeah.
Seth, do you ever get surprised with someone does something, because you've write as well, where someone does something with your words that you didn't imagine that being a possibility, and you go, oh, I didn't think of it being performed like
absolutely.
That. That's so interesting.
Absolutely. And I think it's really those kind of decisions. There's a demeanor that everyone has when they audition that I think says a lot about the person. And it says a lot about how, you know, auditioning is just like any other skill, right? You do it enough, you're going to get better at it. And I feel like you can really see how many people have auditioned so many times that they're not nervous. What, you're going to tell me no again for the 1500th time? Boo fucking who? Let's go. Let's do it. You know what I mean? Like, you can sense that.
Yeah. You do it 1000 times and it's like, I feel comfortable here. At one point it felt like a prison and I couldn't wait to get out. I'd leave before my last line. I'm just like, okay, thank you. Bye.
Yeah.
You know, but like a prisoner institutionalized in that jail cell, you're sort of like, actually, this is where I thrive, man. I've done this 1000 times and there's nothing I haven't seen. So you kind of get that confidence. And then you're also like, dude, I can do this. You have a problem and I'm here to solve it. I'm just the guy throwing in my bid. You might go with the taller dude out there, but couldn't care less. I'm just here to do my thing. When you overcome that, it's so easy. It's so easy.
And so many times as an actor, like, it's just a, like so many things in life, it's just a matter of perspective, where like, I think when I have an audition, that's what I am doing that day. That is, as an actor, that is my job that day. I'm not thinking about where that could go or what comes after. So I walk into a room or I do a self-tape here at home and I go, this is what I'm doing. And when I'm done with it, I've done my job for the day and I'm done with it. If I hear in 2 days that I have a callback, then I will address that as my job that day. But today I do it and I'm done.
Right.
Another really, like, this just isn't talked about enough. And I think that this will, like, really, I don't know, everyone who's just been told no so many times. I mean, honest to God, 95% of casting really, I mean, like, yeah, obviously if you get into that last 5%, it comes down to performance, all that stuff, but 95% of it comes down to what you look like. It really, really, really does.
Things that are not in your control.
Yeah.
Story, seriously. And everything. You have to think about the audience. And if we're in network TV, our audience is 55 Donna from Minnesota, and you have to look like a cop. because that's what she's going to believe. You know, like we,
definitely.
It is. And, you know, acting is a lot of communication. Communication is a lot nonverbal, and it's easier to tell the story when the bad guy has a scar on his face.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, you know? Too. Absolutely. It's one of those things too. It's like, I need my main character's face to be a little bit more likable. It's like, you know, even though that guy might be a way better actor, it's like, that guy just fits what I need for this story a little bit more.
And it's your bone structure and how the light's hitting you and all that stuff. It has nothing to, maybe it has nothing to do with what you did in the audition room. Open up your eyes and look at the whole picture.
I would say you're not the only person here, right? A lot of the time it doesn't.
We just had an episode with an actor here in New York who's like just guest star and everything. His name's Robert Eli, and he has one of those incredible faces that's like a little unspecific in that he could be the lovely dad next door, or he could be a villain. And it just, whatever clothes you put him in whatever scenario, you go, yeah, he's the cool dad next door. Or you put a leather jacket on and a gun and you're like, oh, he looks like he could hurt you. But he has one of those very rare faces that could very easily go either way. But a lot of people don't. And, you know, you see somebody and you go, that just seems odd. But, you know, it's all that shit that has nothing to do with you. And it's not something you can control.
No, but what you can control is knowing your type and how you look. And what I know that if there's a cop show in Chicago, I'm going out for it. Why? Because I'm an Irish fucking cop soldier. I'm Kirkpatrick and O'Brien forever, and that's fine. I know that that's what I look like, and so that's I gun for stuff like that for network TV. It determines the medium that I choose: TV, film, theater, whatever. It is so dependent on how I look, but I have to know and be aware of what I look like and what my muscles are and what I offer in order to properly get myself out there. You're tenure in your path is no different from anybody who goes through struggle and finds success. So I just want to quickly talk about the struggle that you endured for the early part of your career before things started kind of picking up. What did you do to, one, get through like the emotional and mental turmoil of that hopelessness and uncertainty? And two, what were the actions that you had to take just to survive?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough, dude. That's super tough. It's not talked about enough in our industry how depressing this stuff can be. I mean, it can just be like crippling. But I mean, for the longest time, I mean, I was shooting commercials. I mean, thank God I was even getting commercials at the time, but like, it just becomes so depressing when you start dumping everything you have into this and it's still not working. But like, I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of like, all you got to do is keep at it. That's it.
And endurance. So much of in acting is not quitting.
Yeah, that's it. And if you think about all of the legends of this industry, whether it's, you know, Martin Scorsese or Daniel Day-Lewis or all of those people, I mean, the one thing they all have in common is that they didn't fucking quit, right? Like, if you ever want to be that good, that's the one thing that every successful person has in common. So like, it's one of those things that you knock on the door long enough and loud enough, someone's going to answer. So it's just consistency at the end of the day. Now, the depression side of it, that's like a whole nother thing that's just like tough. But I found just some kind of peace in bugging the shit out until it happens. And that was the thing about like the kind of studios, right? It wasn't about like, I've thought about this a lot. And a little bit more recently, because one of my managers brought it up to me, it wasn't about the studio system, like being anti-studio. That's not what it's about at all. It's about being anti-no, right? You're going to tell me no, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyways. And it's one of those things that when you start having that mentality, you start to not get no's, because people want to be on something that's about to take off. And those no's turn into yes pretty quickly. So.
Well, and I think you have to change a perspective where no doesn't mean no. No means find another way.
Yeah, I haven't.
No means it's not here, but you're going to get in the side door. Good luck getting in. But there is a trap door, but it ain't here.
Yeah,
and it's just totally about your resourcefulness of getting in there. Send a fucking fruit basket. Do whatever you can.
I haven't said it the right way. If it's a no, you know what I mean. Like, there's still, you know, yeah.
Right.
I can say it a different way and get a yes. You know.
I love that yeah. because normal people who live in the normal world doing the normal, no means no. And you're like, okay, that's it then. I'm just not going to have the dream then. That's fine. I'm going to go sell whatever, totally. You know? But for us, it's like, oh, no. This is, I hear no, but my, you know, we said this in an earlier episode. You hear no, but really your heart speaks louder than the no that you've heard.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
You just have that conviction. That inner conviction comes from what? I don't know, but it must be your truth. Because once you hit that success like you have, and that validation comes in, and all those depressing fucking long days and cold nights and just being alone and you know, everybody checking off boxes of life accomplishments, and you're still like swiping that food stamp card at the fucking grocery, you know, and then next week you're on a huge shoot, and that sort of volatility and those ups and downs, those peaks and valleys, this is a mountain range. Mm-hmm. You know, if there weren't downs, it would just be a plateau, you know? So you have to accept that and expect it.
Absolutely.
So going forward, Seth, what's up next for you, and what's going to be, any changes that you make in your strategy to how you're going through, the next chapter of this business now that you've got a few more keys.
Yeah. So I'm doing a few things. I'm doing, this summer I spent a lot of time. I found two directors that I really liked here in Chicago, and I loved their work, and they were kind of at the same level as I was, of like, they've got a really good script and they just needed help getting it made, and just kind of through Echo, I could kind of plug in some things that they needed. So I produced one movie in July, which had Mason Gooding Jr.'s son, Mason Gooding, in it. And Cuba Gooding Jr.'s son, Mason Gooding, in it. And it had the girl from Modern Family, Ariel Winters. We're doing another one here in October, November. So I'll help those two just get made, just because, I don't know, like, I've been there. I've seen it. If I can help you get your movie made, I'm definitely going to do it. That's for sure.
Totally.
And then top of 2022, we just started shopping a series. That's going to be the next thing I'm going to direct. It's going to be a series called The Merc, and it's going to be 1980s Chicago trading. And it's going to be killer. It's going to be unbelievable. In the 80s, from 1980 to 87, I mean, they stole down there like you wouldn't believe. And so we kind of take, like, it's kind of like The Sopranos meets a little bit of The Big Short, where you're kind of explaining what's going on and you're understanding how they're treated every single day.
Oh, I love that style. Yeah. I mean, you're dissecting a whole thing with the narrative. I love that. That's awesome. Okay, so that's 2022.
That'll be 2022. We just started shopping it, and we've instantly got some great interest, like killer interest. And so now it's just trying to figure out how we're going to format it. Do we want it to be, and we're thinking we do, we want it to be a longer form series. So we're talking 10 episodes on a bigger streamer so that we can really get that production design behind it. And it's going to be good, man. That one's going to be one that once that first season comes out, people are going to, they're going to lose their shit. And we're keeping a theme of, like, for me as a director, I think a lot of what I love to make is how people cheat the system. Right. And with Echo Boomers, it was about that. And with this one, it's kind of the same thing, just slightly in a different era.
Does that come from a personal attachment to rebelliousness?
Yeah, that I can't do. You know, I can't go out there and, you know, cheat the markets like these guys did.
But, and that's part of the storytelling, is like, you get to do stuff that you can't do in real life. And it's a way that you can experience something without going to jail for it.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And what those guys did in the 80s here in Chicago, I mean, Chicago at the time was, it had just gotten bigger than the New York Stock Exchange. They had less rules. Wow. They were self-regulated. I mean, it was pretty fun.
Oh, man. We're very excited about this. That's awesome. Congratulations. Yeah. That's great. Well, Seth, what about, you know, we'll let you go here in a second, but I want to ask you, we have a lot of our audience is just starting out, they're aspiring or struggling. You know, this is a podcast where we help a lot of people, and we try to tell them, you know, wherever you are, you're right where you need to be, because we were there or we are there. So for filmmakers and actors alike, what would you say to the people behind you coming up, the next generation, just starting out? Any advice?
Man, shoot as much as you possibly can. Like, I know a lot of and I tell that to everyone, whether you're an actor, whether you're a cinematographer, director. I mean, at the end of the day, it all comes down to getting those reps in, you know, like how many times have you done this? And whether it's something that's paying you or not, you know, yeah, you know, as when you first start off, just get in the room, man. Just get in the room.
First 10 movies, I had to pay to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's a really good mentality to say. And like, so what if you're directing a shitty music video? You're getting that rep in, man. Like, that's exciting. And that's kind of the number one thing. And another thing that I really just want to press again is that, like, even if you're just starting out, just like, you know, I didn't have a feature before Echo, and I had 2 Academy nominees and Patrick Schwarzenegger fake doing blow in my movie. Like, that's America right there. You know what I mean? But it came down to just not, like, you can reach those people that do give you yeses. You can, even if you've never done it before, like, just addressing it politely and figuring out how to navigate and communicate with that person is totally doable.
Yeah. And we have people to look at every day who have these success stories where a year before, 5 years before, there was this huge struggle, this huge speed bump, this huge mountain that seemed unscalable. But I guess what you're saying is, like, anything is possible. If you're given that, no, it's just, you got to find the other way. There's always a way. You just have to find that entrance.
Yeah. Like, the only person who's going to kill your dream is you, right? Like,
right,
if you're the one who says, you know what, that was it, I'm done, then yeah, it's never going to happen. But if you never let it get to that point, then you're putting that energy out into the world, right? Like, it's going to happen eventually. It's just a matter of time. So.
Amen. And where can people find you, Seth?
You can find me on Instagram, Seth Savoy.
Seth Savoy, S-A-V-O-Y.
That's it.
Okay, awesome.
Seth, thank you so much for joining us, man. This was awesome. Absolutely. I think this will be great to hear from people on the other side of the camera and for actors. I think this will be really beneficial.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this, guys. This was fun.
I'm glad you came around, man. Best of luck with everything. We'll keep tabs on you, and we're excited for 2022. Yep.
All right, talk soon, guys.
Adios.
Thank you, Seth. Oh, that was great.
Yeah. He's awesome. You know, I was serious when I came onto that set and he was behind that camera. Initially, immediately, I was like, oh, there's something about him. I really, really, and I had it with Benjamin too. I've had it with so many wonderful DPs, but you know, when it's there, you can sense their composure. You can sense their inner peace amongst the chaos that's going on. And I immediately am put to rest by just their vibe and their energy. And that's the guy that is basically like a landmark for a lot of the crew and the vibe of everything else forward stems from the director, the actor, that DP. I mean, he's one of the head honchos,
and you know, it's, he has an actor on camera. You have to be aware this is a visual medium. Mm-hmm. And when you, as the actor, feel safe with the DP and you're kind of on the same page, it relaxes you a little bit. And you're like, all right, me and my performance are going to be taken care of because I trust you. They trust me. You know, there's like a symbiotic relationship there between camera and the actor. But when you know and trust the person behind the camera, it's a great relationship.
Totally.
And it puts you at ease as an actor.
100%. I think it's like being in a home with a functional, like, parent. That person is a constant source of support, and they're just there, and you never see them get angry, and you never see them blow up. They're just constant, and they're consistent, and you can rely on them for everything. They set the tone of the household. And I really do believe, like, if it was a dysfunctional family where the person would erupt or had bad choices, or, you know, I wouldn't have that trust. So Seth's a good daddy. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Is that the name of the episode?
Yeah. Hey, everybody.
Our new filmmaker series with Seth Savoy. Seth's a good daddy.
Thanks for listening, everybody. You can find out more about Before the Break and how to become a working actor at workingactorpro.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Before the Break Pod and Working Actor Pro. Adam can can be found at adamdecarlo.com and follow him at @AdamDeCarlo. And you can find me at TommyBeardmore.com. Follow me at TommyBeyond. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a rating, and write a review if you like what you heard. Check back next week for an all-new episode with an all-new guest. That's fucking it.
We done?
Yeah. Adios.
Okay. Bye. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Before the Break. The hosts are Tommy Beardmore and Adam DeCarlo. Cover art by Amanda June Boucher. Music by Benjamin Sturley. Before the Break is recorded live from Los Angeles and New York City.